Beasley Media Group, BMI, and HD Radio present 100 Years of Radio, 100 Years of Hitmakers, where we celebrate a century of country radio hits written by some of the greatest songwriters of all time.
Hey, this is Brian Ives. I'm the managing editor of Beasley Media, and I'm hosting a series of interviews with country's best songwriters. We're digging deep, talking about some of their biggest hits. You may not know their names, but you definitely know their songs. This week, we're talking to Jesse Frazier, who co-wrote Kane Brown and Marshmello's One Thing Right, Thomas Rhett's Life Changes, and also songs for Kelsey Ballerini, Lauren Elena, Florida Georgia Line, and many more. Check it out. So Jesse, let's just get into it. Talk to me about Kane Brown's song One Thing Right, which was an unusual and very successful collaboration with Marshmello.
I've been at the wrong place at the wrong time, chasing all the wrong things most of my life, and every kind of loss that you can't find, but I got one thing.
Yeah, it's been crazy over the last probably 3 to 5 years. We've been seeing a lot of the EDM collaborations with country music kind of across the board. But that song came from a writing trip for Kane. We were actually at his label head's lake house, and he had a bunch of songwriters out just about a couple hours outside Nashville. And he was kind of wanting to do something in a direction of like a Khalid vibe, but for country music. So we made that song, and it was kind of stripped down, and it never quite fit his album at the time. I think it was probably a little bit too pop-leaning for that current album that he was putting together. So we shot it over to Marshmello, and they flipped out over it. So it was really cool seeing that whole thing come together, and then, you know, obviously did pretty well in the pop charts. And the reach, the cool thing about the EDM world is they reach a lot of playlists that our genre and country doesn't touch, specifically just internationally. So it's amazing to kind of see the outreach and the amount of streams that come from all these different playlists. And it's really healthy, I think, right now to see these collaborations between country and EDM.
I'm sure with every 10 years, every, you could call it a generation in country music, the older people are like, I don't like what they're doing today. You know, I remember even when Garth was getting huge, it's like, why is he flying over the arena and why is he doing all this rock stuff? You know,
sure.
But it felt really different when you guys did that song and Marin collaborated with Zedd. Like, what do you think changed that made it okay to work with, you know, EDM artists when that wouldn't have happened even maybe 5 years before that?
I think it's a two-part thing. You know, it's funny you just, what you brought up, we were watching that Ken Burns documentary on country music, and the amount of haters that there's always been, you know, when country music moved from just a bluegrass style in general, there was people that kind of hated on it and thought that that was too progressive. And so throughout the history of any style of music, whether it's Bob Dylan picking up an electric guitar or whatever, you know, people get attached to what they think something should be. But country music's never been one thing. You know, it's never been one sound throughout the history of it. So to me, what I love most about Nashville is this creative, like, safety net around the whole city for people just to come and make great music. The thing that's kind of changed in the last 3 to 5 years as far as the collaborations go is I don't know necessarily that our artists weren't into it. It was more just the stigma. I think there's a stigma from LA to Nashville at times that, you know, there's been a lot of collaboration amongst the creators, but maybe the artist didn't think it was cool to collaborate with a country artist. You know, that's probably what really changed things is people like FGL doing the collaboration with Alesso and Haley Steinfeld. And then, you know, even before that, Cruz kind of opening the door to a different sound. Guys like the Chainsmokers doing collaborations with FGL and Kelsey, and then slowly and surely, then you start, obviously the Zedd thing, like you mentioned, was a huge smash. And that was a song that several pop artists had tried, and they ended up picking Marin's vocal, you know? So a lot of it is a combination of the artists and the creators like myself in town were raised on lots of styles of music. You know, we're not raised in one genre anymore. We grew up listening to playlists all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. And then the combined with the simple fact that, like I said, all of a sudden it's cool Nashville's a knit city. Country music isn't, you know, you got Diplo in a cowboy hat now. So, I mean, it's just a different time and a different style. And like you said, there's a cyclical thing. Things come around. People get more open-minded. And we have a very, very loyal fan base. And I think some of the pop artists probably started to see, like, wow, look, you know, regardless of what goes down, this country audience is kind of unwavering. And really, when they're passionate about something, they stick with that artist a long time.
I mean, I think somebody like Nelly, who hasn't come up through country music, probably appreciates the loyalty that he sees from that country music artist get, because he's done shows with McGraw and he's done shows with FGL. And now he has his own song or remix with Kane. And it's probably like, you know, maybe when he first came out in 2001 or whatever, he wouldn't have thought about doing a country song, but now he's probably like, you know, most other genres leave their older artists in the dust, whereas, you know, country fans stick forever.
That's a great point. And I mean, in going back to FGL as kind of trailblazers, that tour specifically, that baseball stadium tour, they brought me out to DJ. That was my first time writing with them. And I wrote Sundays on that trip. That was my first number one, which was the same tour where Nelly is this ginormous hip hop star from our childhood, you know, in high school days, is opening their show. It was crazy.
So I wanted to ask about, you know, you've had a huge run of great singles with Thomas Rhett. So let me ask about some of them. Talk about Life Changes.
It's weird when you do such an autobiographical song. It's one thing to be like, oh, you know, a love song, this is the story about how we met. But that song is literally so specific to his story. I mean, we have Uganda in a country song. And then production-wise, to have tubas and piccolo and like marching band vibes. So we really were nervous about the song. It was like the last song we wrote for the Life Changes record. And we wrote it at his farm.
I remember the day I told my daddy and mama, you're gonna have a grandkid. Yep. From Uganda, that's right.
It was like a snowy blizzard day. I don't know if we could leave the farm. We got stuck there for 2-3 days. And we kind of were a little bit nervous to put it out as a single, just because it felt like it was going to be a little too specific. But it translated so well, it did great on radio, and it really goes off great live too. People just love that song. I think it's kind of one of those almost rap-esque verse phrases, you know, that's easy to sing and hooky, and it really kind of resonated with the teenage girls, and you know, which is an amazing fan base to get, because they really are consumers, you know, like true consumers, whether it's t-shirts to sweatshirts to music. So it really kind of just resonated across the board, and it's funny when you look back over the ones that you're like, oh my gosh, is this going to work? And then you're like, oh yeah, everyone knows it all along at the end of the tunnel, you know. But as you're going into it, you're pretty scared, because every step of the way with Thomas, there's been a couple risky moves, you know, whether that was going from the first album into Crash and Burn. That was a very nerve-wracking thing for him. But along the way, putting songs out like Life Changes, you know, there's not a guaranteed pass that country radio is going to play you. So the fact that they did and it worked so well, that was an awesome story.
I mean, I think people have been really invested in his story, and he shared the story of like him and his wife wanting to have kids and then adopting a kid and all that stuff. And like you say, the Uganda thing is like, that's pretty specific to him. Like what other country singer or any singer really could sing that particular line truthfully. So how do you do it when you're writing a song with him like that? I mean, are the lyrics all him, or you're writing stuff that, you know, comes from his life and he sort of is approving it, or are you laying down chords? Like what do you do with a Thomas Rhett when you're writing a song like that with and for him?
Yeah. Thomas is a stronger artist writer than even most. There's a lot of artist writer people in Nashville, but Thomas is one of the strongest. I mean, he is, if the artist career ever goes away, he'd be a very, very successful and has had a lot of commercial placements with other artists as just a writer. So his viewpoints are always pretty strong in the room. He usually has people around him that are editors or collaborators, in the sense of we'll play him tracks or music that we like, and then it's just sort of trying to get out what he's saying, you know, wanting to say. So that one specifically, we started with the chord changes and built up a groove around that. And then, you know, he was just going through a lot. He had a lot in his mind. You know, it was like basically two kids very quickly. So that was, you know, a heavy presence on his mind. And we had a lot of freedom because the record we thought was pretty much done. So there is a kind of stress relief that comes off of you when you write and, you know, you already got some great stuff in the can. So you really don't limit yourself, you know. So yeah, but you know, is for someone that is so used to telling his story, his love story, putting his family first and all kinds of songs and talking about them, it still was a nerve-wracking aspect even for him to go, man, this might be a little too inside, you know. So yeah, that was pretty cool that that worked out.
And it definitely did. Talk about Crash and Burn then.
Crash and Burn is a song I wrote with Chris Stapleton. My wife introduced me to Chris years and years ago. They worked at the same publishing company together. He was a writer there, and she was a song plugger. And he was kind of, you know, wasn't really getting a ton of attention as an artist at the time. He was getting some cuts as a writer. He was just, yeah, couldn't really get the artist thing going. And so I would get together at night with him. I was a song plugger. I hadn't really gotten many cuts at the time, and I was just running a publishing company. So in the evenings after work, he'd come over, and I'm from Detroit, and I love his voice, and he loves soul music as much as I do. So we would just make these songs, like we'd call them like sad songs for dance floors, just kind of like soul jam Motown EPs, and we're like, oh, maybe we'll pitch these to Bruno Mars or something, you know. And we did like I don't know, four or five of them. And the CD was kind of floating around town of this stuff. And everyone's like, oh my gosh, have you heard Stapleton singing this kind of Motown-esque stuff, you know? And somehow, I think it was Thomas's business manager gave him a copy of the CD. I think Chris and Thomas share the same business manager, or they did at the time. And Thomas heard this and reached out to us. And I think at the time, Gary Allen was also pretty interested in the song. Mm. And I was a huge Gary Allen fan, and I didn't know too much about Thomas. And what I did know about Thomas from the first album, he was awesome. I just didn't really understand why he was into Crash and Burn. It didn't make any sense to me, because he was kind of more in the Cole Swindell, Dustin Lynch kind of lane at the time. And just didn't make, I couldn't picture it. But he called me up one day and said, man, obviously, I'm a little bit nervous that I'm going to pull this off after hearing Stapleton's voice, but I love this song. I think I want to try something different to stand out on this next album, and I'd love you to produce this with me and Dan Huff. So that was the kickoff point. So I think to this day, it's probably my favorite song just because of the story, you know, the fact that we wrote it not trying to get a country cut. We just wrote a song that we loved. And obviously, Chris is such an amazing singer and writer as well. So it's so fun to work with him. And the fact that that song kind of just found its way without trying to, found its way and then ended up, you know, being a kickoff. We call that whole era for Make Me Wanna Crash and Burn, then leading into Die Happy Man. What a changing point for Thomas Rhett's career.
Yeah.
Huge changing point for my career. That was the first song that, you know, we're just wrapping up album 5 for Thomas Rhett. So this is the fourth one I've done, but all from Crash and Burn.
Wow.
So it's pretty wild.
Wow. So talk about Thomas's Unforgettable. It's crazy, I remember every detail, but I do. From your blue jeans to your shoes,
girl, that night was just like you, unforgettable. Unforgettable was, you know, that's an amazing song on radio that kind of just feels like, we wanted to go for a tempo that was up-tempo and positive, could be a show closer. And we wanted it to kind of have a Coldplay as kind of anthemic vibe to it, you know.
Yeah.
And again, with the rapid fire verses, I do think there's sometimes something about that, you know. It's like, I think you would think, oh, that's complicated to sing, but I'm a huge fan of verses that are as hooky as the chorus. I've been thinking that it's crazy, I remember every detail, but I do. I can still smell your perfume, girl, that night was just like you.
Right.
So whenever we're writing, I'm trying to either find a melody signature hook or some sort of phrasing style that gets people in right away. And just like Life Changes, that right off the bat there, I mean, it's like a ton of lyrics. And it's just, I think it has a cool little, you know, almost nursery rhyme bounce to it that I think is hooky from the top. We wrote that on his bus. I think that was me and Shane McAnally and Ashley and him. And we write a ton on the buses, so we'll leave on Wednesday night, basically set up a little mini studio and come back Sunday morning. And it's really great because you get to go out on the road and see how songs are translating. And, you know, up-tempos are always the hardest to write. Mm. Just because, especially for someone like TR, he loves writing the ballads and love songs. So it's always kind of hard for us to kind of get into that tempo lane with him. So when you nail one that is positive and up-tempo and fun and not like a partying, drinking song, it's it usually goes off pretty good. So that was a fun one.
But I think, you know, it may not be like that kind of, you know, Luke Bryan, FGL type partying song. But I think there's something about those guys growing up when they grew up, you know, when hip hop is just part of the culture. And, you know, I guess if you hate it, you could keep it out of your music. But if you like it, it's gonna influence you, even if you're not trying to be an MC or you're not trying to be a hip hop producer.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is like the amount of 808s and hip hop samples that we have in Thomas Rhett's music is staggering. Mm. You know, I mean, I grew up listening to Motown and Daft Punk and Tupac. You know, I mean, that's what I loved. And that's the kind of stuff that really, really resonates with me. And what I gravitate towards in styles of music when I write, we're taking all those little things. And he's the same way. He grew up listening to a lot of country music, Blink 182, and a lot of emo rock and a lot of hip hop, you know. So throughout his records, that's kind of common themes.
What drove you, you know, mentioning that you were what you grew up listening to, what got you into country then?
Well, moving to town, I loved the Keith Urban record, the Golden Road record, and the Set the Circus Down Tim McGraw record kind of opened up my eyes to, wow, this isn't, you know, your father's country music. This is something that I actually can really get into and like and enjoy. So it basically kind of changed my mentality, and I did fall in love with the town. I had an uncle that played drums in Nashville, and I moved from Michigan State down to Belmont to go to school. And originally I came to be a songwriter, and I just was a little bit intimidated by the craft of the writing in Nashville and didn't think I could pull it off. So, but I loved music, so I thought, well, maybe I'll just be a publisher and work with songwriters. Mm. And I did that. I got an internship, and I just kept – I was a DJ, and I would travel the country and DJ on the weekends. And then I would just be a publisher during the weekdays, and that was my gig for about 12 years. I didn't get a cut till 12 years after the move to Nashville.
Wow.
And by the time I got a cut, I was also the VP of the publishing company. So, yeah. So, you know, I kind of came up helping songwriters. I came here to be a songwriter and then gave up on that. And then it ended up finding me, but again, not from trying. Like it, from writing pop music, I ended up becoming a country songwriter. And, you know, being a DJ, Seth England, Florida Georgia Lions manager, begging me to go out and DJ for Florida Georgia Lion, and me going, oh man, I don't really want to go do a country DJ tour, but if you let me write with the boys, I'll go. And that was the you know, trade off. So just those kind of things where everything in my life that has led me to be a country songwriter had nothing to do with country music.
Right.
Whether it was my influences, whether it was Crash and Burn, not trying to write a country song, whether it was working with Shea Mooney, who was signed to T-Pain, and Meghan Trainor, who was 17, just moved from Nantucket, before he met Dan and Dave, so joined Dan and Shay. So they were two pop writers. We wrote a pop song, and I like the sound of that, came from that. Writing a reggae, somewhat of a lazy pot smoking anthem, Sundays, comes out of that, you know. So throughout my whole career, I am the poster child for people saying pick a lane. I'm the opposite.
Right.
I don't believe in you have to be laser focused and put 110% into this one direction. I've never been one direction. I've never been one genre. I would not be talking to you today if it wasn't for hip hop and pop and DJing and all kinds of stuff. That's literally what got me into country music.
I mean, you're a guy who makes your money, you know, makes a good living from being in country music, but you're underneath Jay-Z's Roc Nation umbrella.
Right.
I mean, that would have been inconceivable, you know, 10 years ago or more, I think.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's one of those things that even when people say that out loud, you know, I've got a picture of us when we signed. I just keep it in my studio. And, you know, you're riding around in your pickup truck that I spent more money on the speaker system than the truck was worth listening to Jay-Z records. So to think that we could, from country music, partner up with one of my childhood heroes, you know, and be their first imprint in Nashville, you know, that's just stuff that you really, my story is crazy. It gets really almost emotional when you kind of go back through it like that and kind of think about, you couldn't have scripted that and tried that by just going, oh, I'm going to do this. You know, it's just like, it really kind of goes to show you that you can just be yourself and do your thing and do all the things that influence you and still find a way to be in a genre that just, those things don't add up to make sense, you know?
Sure.
Very strange.
It's funny. You mentioned the DJing thing. Years and years ago, I used to work at VH1 and we had the Hip Hop Honors show. And I was interviewing the artist backstage and Kid Rock was there because he was part of the DJ thing with like Grandmaster Flash and a couple of other people. Kid Capri, I think, was one of them. But, you know, and then the next week, I remember he was supposed to be doing something at the CMT Awards. And so I asked him, I'm like, dude, like, you're probably one of the only guys who gets invited to both of those parties. And he said, you know, before I ever learned to play guitar or any other instrument, I was a DJ. And he goes, and I would suggest that any musician learns to DJ because it teaches you about rhythm and it teaches you about breaks and it teaches you about how to get people's attention. And he's like, I've used all that in writing more, you know, rock songs or country songs or whatever. I thought that was fascinating.
You know, even more than the actual technical stuff too for me. And it does, it teaches you about, you know, you're staring at modern DJing. You know, when I started off, it was vinyl and now you use computers a lot. But you're listening for the beats and the transients on a track. And you're also nowadays witnessing it, you know, much like production and seeing where things start and stop and how you blend stuff in. But most importantly for me, and the same reason why I like going on tour and writing, is people on a dance floor, you can think something is cool and cutting edge and it can go over like a bomb. Mm. Like if you DJ a wedding, like I've DJed for parties for Drake and Lil Wayne and Nicki Minaj and I DJed random weddings like Alyssa Milano's wedding and whatever. So the most nerve-wracking gig ever is a wedding because you've got a grandma, you've got aunts and uncles, you've got 18-year-old bridesmaid, you know, you've got this crazy spectrum of people, right? And you have to keep this dance floor full of people and the party going because nothing's worse than a bad DJ or a bad band, right?
Yeah.
So you have to kind of know what's going to go off and what's okay. If they like this, we're in this middle of this 90s retro break. I just played No Diggity. Okay. I'm going to go into Shoop or, you know, Beyonce or whatever else it is. I have to know where I'm going next. And I can't let my ego get in the way of going, oh, I'm going to drop this brand new, you know, whatever track.
Right.
And I think it's dope because it just came out Friday. But all of a sudden the dance floor empties, you know,
right.
What they really wanted to hear next was Uptown Funk.
Right.
But you didn't play that because you're like, oh, that's 7 years old. You know, like all of a sudden you can't get your ego and become this narcissist DJ. Now, if you're a Diplo and they're coming to see a Diplo set, it's a little different. But if you're a straight up party DJ or you're a commercial songwriter, your job is to get in the room with the artist and help navigate them. And you can kind of have some influence on like, oh man, this would be cool if we did this, or we wrote it this way, or we did this sound. But at the same time, I can't let my, I'm not the artist, right? And just like when I'm a DJ, I'm not the star. They don't care who I am. I just need to keep this party going, you know?
Yeah.
So the bottom line is that's why I think DJ was so important for me, is it makes you watch people. It makes you watch how people react. The difference between a hit song and a smash, you know, it's like you can have I Got a Feeling from the Black Eyed Peas, and then you can have a recent number one on pop charts. There's a song that a grandma knows and puts her hands up to.
Right.
And then there's a song that, oh, maybe this 15-year-old listens to headphones with. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Let me we keep getting off track. Let me ask you about another time. No, it's cool. It's interesting to talk to you and hear your perspective. Tell me about Marry Me.
Man, the only reason that song works is because it was the ultimate plot twist for an artist that is so love focused. So, oh my gosh, I love my family. Oh my gosh, I love Lauren. Talk about it, you know, put her up on a pedestal. And then sitting on the bus, we wrote that the same weekend, is unforgettable. And sitting on the bus kind of going, man, wouldn't it be crazy if we just took your story, but you didn't go to her house that day and say, hey, I know you're dating somebody, but, you know, I don't think you should be. What's it like for that dude that's just a family friend now and watching the one that got away? And for some reason, I guess because it's got a really nice kind of pretty pop-like melody on it. But it's so funny that the song worked so well and works so well live. Like, it's a ballad, but people sing along and scream along to it as if it's a positive love song. And it's pretty gut-wrenching, you know? So, but I think, I don't know, I guess just because all of a sudden everyone was like, oh my gosh, like it felt heartfelt because they had seen the opposite for so long from him.
Yeah.
It was pretty wild.
Nah, it's an interesting concept for a song for sure. What about Remember the Young?
Remember You Young is one of my most recent number ones with him. And that we kind of just wanted a Billy Joel style heartfelt song. So we wanted it to be like, oh my gosh, we're going to have some stuff about your kids in there. But it's more than that, man. It's like, it's about, look, I do believe that amongst the people you love, sometimes they're frozen in your mind in a certain way. And we were actually out on tour again. And I think we were supposed to write Shay that day because Dan and Shay were out with us. And I don't think Shay, I think he was either hungover or didn't show up or something. So me and Ashley and Thomas sat in the back of the bus and started playing around with that. And his kids were literally just outside the bus kind of playing on this little play mat area. And that's kind of where the premise came from. But trying to make sure that it didn't just become like this dad-only song. I'll always remember you. And to me, that concept, you know, is such a universal thought, whether it's about your wife or it's about your buddies. And it doesn't matter how prim and proper people get and how cleaned up their lives get. You still remember when you got wasted with them, or you're holding their hair back while they're puking, or whatever it is, right? So, you know, that to me kept it from being just a lovey-dovey vibe and more of like a, you know, you can almost hold the lighter up and drink a beer to it kind of ballad.
Tell me about Kelsea Ballerini's Hole in the Bottle.
I'm in Florida right now. We actually wrote that down here on a retreat. And it was late. We were all wasted. We had all definitely been drinking. I think it was probably 2 a.m. And I think one of our writers was in the kitchen and actually said that line, like, just because obviously we had been clearing out some vodka and wine bottles pretty quickly. Had this track that I originally was kind of intending for, you know, thought maybe Thomas could do it or someone. I didn't really know. I just made it. But I'm really interested in like combining genres. Obviously, we've been talking about that a ton. So I had this like Johnny Cash, Get Rhythm kind of vibe.
Right.
Like almost rockabilly-esque Sun Records vibe with straight up like Jaquan, Everybody in the Club Get Tipsy. Like that was the two things. You know,
right.
Those two. Like Chet Atkins guitar and in the club drums, and it kind of just all came together. So yeah, just late night writes. And I had Googled this 1950s binge drinking public service announcement and spliced that into the top, and she loved it and ended up licensing that to add it to her album. So that PSA is actually a real binge drinking, the dangers of binge drinking, especially I think it's targeted to women, telling them that, you know, how drinking makes you look non-classy. So yeah, that thing's awesome. I'm pretty proud of that, and it was cool. That was my first time producing something for her.
There are many people who drink in moderation with no problems, social, moral, or medical. They have learned to enjoy liquor without letting it upset the functioning of their body and mind. It relaxes you.
We were talking earlier about Florida Georgia Line, and you were part of writing Sundays, right?
Yes, yep.
Yeah, tell me about that one.
Sundays was my first number one, and that's from that trip. So, you know, I was asked to go DJ that Nelly tour. At the time, I've never been a famous DJ, but I got kind of into a circuit with a couple big party planners, and I started doing these parties for Cash Money Records and Drake and Lil Wayne, and Seth, who manages Florida Georgia Line, had heard about that and said, man, I want to take you out. You'll be the perfect fit for this. We got Nelly opening up, and I don't want it to be, because I was like, ah, dude, I don't really want to do a country tour. It's no offense against these country tour DJs. I don't really want to spin country music. You know, I love country music. I just don't want to DJ that. Like when I DJ, that's not what I play, you know? And he's like, no, just play whatever you want, man. Just do whatever. So we put together some mashups. So I would do like Blake Shelton, you know, Boys Around Here with No Diggity mashups and all that kind of stuff. But for the most part, we're just spinning hip hop records. But part of the agreement was, hey, dude, the last weekend, I want to rent my own bus. I'll pay for it if you'll give me a ride with the boys. And he agreed to that and talked the guys into doing it, because they didn't really know me. I didn't have much going on. And I had a couple little baby cuts. I think Toby Mac had cut one of my songs, a couple people in town, but nothing big. I hadn't had any hits yet. And they came on the bus, and I had brought – so the bus I rented broke down like three times because I was paying for it out of pocket. So just trying to save money, I got this cheap-ass bus. And I had talked Kerry Barlow and Sarah Buxton into coming out with me and said, hey, look, I think we're going to get to write with FGL. And talked him into it. We leave Nashville. We wake up at like 4 a.m. on the side of the road while it broke down. So the whole first day of that weekend was a mess, because by the time we got to the venue, I had to rush to the DJ booth. Didn't even get to write. So the next day we wake up, Seth makes the boys come to our bus, and they're kind of reluctant because they're like, they said, hey, guys, I got to let you know, we're pretty much done with the album. We've already cut 15 sides, but, you know, we can fool around for a little bit, but I'm going to go. Tyler said, I want to go for a motorcycle ride. So he's like, got about 2 hours. Well, we wrote this song called Good Good that ended up on the record. And then that night, Brian Kelly said, man, that went pretty good today. You know, we've been talking about doing like a Pitbull collaboration, something that maybe had a little bit of a reggae vibe. So all night long, going to the next city, myself and Kerry Barlow made the track for Sundays. And we had the melody, and Brian kind of came on the bus just basically saying, you know, man, all I want to do today is wear my favorite shades and get stoned. And that kind of just became the thing. So, and then it's funny because as we're writing it, my publisher brain was kicking in. Your publisher brain is the logic business side. The writer brain is the free-spirited, anything's possible side, right?
Sure.
So my publisher brain was just going, there ain't no way in hell this song's going to see the light of day. Mm. I mean, this is a reggae song. They've got Dirt out on country radio right now. This song's kind of got pot nuances to it. it's just, this is a dead end song, but at least we got that other one recorded. And then 2 weeks later, they called me and said, man, we're going to cut the song and it's going to be our next single.
Wow.
And yeah, so another great lesson in nobody knows. I don't believe people can tell you they know a hit song. I think that we all have track records. Guys like Ashley have had 50 number ones. You know, you have a little bit of a gut going, that sounds pretty good. I like that. But none of us know. We've all been a part of songs we thought would go off really well and tanked and died in the 40s. And we've been a part of things like Sundays that if you told me at the time, do you want to, you know, place money on this song going number one, I wouldn't even bet on it being cut, you know.
Wow.
So it's very strange.
I wanted to ask about, I know you worked with Lauren Elena on Road Less Traveled. I actually interviewed her when that record came out, and I thought it was pretty, I felt like it didn't get the credit deserved. I don't think a lot of women in country music, or even women in any music, but certainly country music, talk so frankly about issues like body image. I hadn't heard it before anyway. So, you know,
right.
talk about like writing those very personal songs with her.
Yeah. You know, that was kind of the thing. It's like doing inspirational songs that are not over the top inspirational are always kind of tricky. If you're not careful, it can get really sappy. And there's nothing wrong with an inspirational message. It's just, it's got to still has to feel like a hit song, you know? So that was kind of a tricky challenge, and we wrote that with Megan Trainor, who was pretty much just focused on being a songwriter in town at the time. And, you know, we kind of just wanted to have an up-tempo vibe and it to be fun and yet still kind of being a, you know, anti-bullying, just be your own person kind of song, you know. She had struggled with a lot of that stuff that's in that song through high school.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of her story coming out. Megan could relate to it. The Megan Trainor that you know now is not the Megan Trainor that we met as songwriters. I mean, she was very humble, quiet. I mean, she's not humble, but very meek and just a quieter person, you know.
I mean, I think she had to become an artist. She had to sort of own who she is. And to do that, she had to have swagger, because if you don't look like a Barbie doll or a model or something, it's tougher on women. And so I think she invented her persona to sort of be able to sell records under her own name. But I feel like she's probably still the person who you knew back then as well.
She definitely is. But for that subject matter, it was perfect, because they definitely could like relate and kind of work off each other on talking about that, you know? So that was like a perfect blend in the writing room that day. Of the two of them kind of just going, man, you know, I can relate. So it's a pretty interesting story that those two were just like vibing off of each other. And our good buddy Busby produced that one.
Right.
And did an amazing job with it. So that was a fun song to be part of with her.
So what, I mean, if those two are really relating on that level, like what is it that you're doing? Does it get uncomfortable? Cause you're like, I don't really know what you're going through. What do I add to this song?
No, my job as a songwriter is again, back to the DJ mentality. You have to check Jesse Frazier at the door and go into, we're writing a song for Lauren Elena today. So, you know, my influence is, oh, maybe we'll say this, or maybe we say that, or maybe that's a little too on the nose, or, you know, maybe kick up some gravel, or let's just talk about some phrasing or ways we can say this to where it's not so like everything's going to be okay over and over again, you know. And then also the sonics of it, and go, man, what if it had a little bit of edge to it and it felt like a, you know, right off the top, it's got really hooky licks on it. So, you know, you're kind of used to that. I've been in plenty of rooms. You're like, man, I can't relate to this at all. But in some ways you can, right? Even if you're not a girl, you're not struggling with some the body image issues, you've struggled with insecurities, or, you know, those are all universal subjects. So we get used to it as storytellers, to kind of getting into the room and sort of just understanding that we have to kind of help this person who's another great songwriter. I mean, Lauren's really talented.
Yeah.
So help this person get this message off their chest and talk about this in a hooky way. That's the key. I'm a real big believer in I love commercial songs, any style. I don't care if it's trap music or all the way back to Marvin Gaye. Mercy Me is an amazing song and a powerful message, but it's also hooky and catchy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Let It Be is a very powerful lyric, but it's also catchy and hooky. I don't think those need to be mutually exclusive. And I think sometimes people get too caught up in thinking that artsy needs to be super left of center sounding. I'm not comparing Road Less Traveled to those songs, by the way. I'm just saying that, you know, I prefer, if we're making music, it needs to be catchy and hooky and timeless. There's never been a standard in history that's not catchy and hooky.
Right.
Period.
Right.
Otherwise, it would not stand the test of time. So anytime we're doing an inspirational thing or it's a powerful story song, it still needs to have a melody and a hook on it, you know? So that's a big thing you can kind of help the artist with as you're going through it as well.
I mean, I imagine when Marvin Gaye sort of submitted Mercy Me, in parentheses, The Ecology, Berry Gordy must have been like, what? You know, like, you're not doing a song about the ecology. Like, who cares? Like, our audience does not care about that. But the song is so hooky, it pulls you in before you really even know what he's singing about.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. It's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
The track, everything about it sounds so good. And, you know, you think about, man, what if he would have been stifled by someone going, that's not going to work, you know, which happens all the time. So,
I mean, it almost happened to him. Berry Gordy did not want him doing any of those songs. But now when people think of Marvin Gaye, they think of What's Going On, you know, which is a song that he did not want him to do. He did not want him addressing those things. Yeah. And, you know, like,
but that's the perfect example of that business brain going, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
You know,
but sometimes you just have to take that leap. You know, you just have to, you know, and I mean, Marvin Gaye doing that led to Stevie Wonder being able to break out of doing like 3-minute singles, which he did great ones, to doing Talking Book and, you know, Music of My Mind and, you know, all the other classic albums that he did on that streak. So, you know,
right.
It's an interesting sort of push and pull, because sometimes artists could go too far and then no one's going to care about it, and then what's the use? But
right.
Sometimes their instincts are right. You just have to, like, give it that leap of faith. Let me ask you about two other songs. I wanted to ask about John Party's Dirt on My Boots. I mean, that's a song that really catapulted that guy into the A-list.
Been up since the crack of dawn, just trying to get paid.
That's another one, though, that if you would have said, man, is this going to be a 3-week number one, I don't know that I would have thought that would be one of my biggest number ones. I based that groove off of, was like, I want to do like a country no diggity. I've said no diggity like 3 times in this interview, but that song is amazing. And I love 90s hip hop, so I wanted that bounce, you know. So we kind of, I started with that acoustic-y feel and that same sort of groove and tempo as the No Diggity. And Rhett Akins and Ashley wrote that with me. And Rhett's kind of just got a really interesting swagger. The melody of that song's really dissonant. Like, if you go back and listen to it, it's like, it's almost minory. And in a lot of ways, that's very hip hop like as well. And for being his country and being a member of the Peach Pickers, as Rhett is, he's actually a huge hip hop fan. So, and that obviously Ashley is too. He DJs with me all the time.
Wow.
So, So it was like a good little combination. We love kind of doing that stuff, like taking the challenge, going, oh man, wouldn't it be great if we had, you know, something like this, but in country music. So that's where that came from. And just the kind of, it's a little bit cocky, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and it's got all the little hip hop isms, and then, you know, the actual demo is way more hip hop sounding, than the track. Bart Butler produced that for John and did an amazing job. That whole bridge section is just all Bart. You know, it's pretty cool.
Interesting. Last one then, Old Dominion, No Such Thing as a Broken Heart. And I think working with them must be different because they're a bona fide country group. You know, like everyone in the band is in the band. They all play their own instruments. You know, they all want to write and stuff. So what's it like working with that as opposed to solo artists? I wonder if
Jack and Diane ever met. Yeah, I mean, specifically Old Dominion, they're all amazing songwriters. You know, the three, Matt and Trevor and Brad, are the main writers, and they've all had hits with going from Chesney to the band Perry to Sam Hunt. You know, so they've had a ton of cuts, and their track record's amazing. No, you can't keep the ground from shaking, no matter how hard you try, can't. And they get along in the writing room surprisingly well, and they all have an opinion, they all have melodies. It was pretty interesting. You know, I was always kind of honored to get invited out on that, because they're not clicky, but they don't write with a ton of people. And it worked out really well. That's another inspirational song that we hid inside a fun message. And another one that's got that rapid fire lyric thing through the verses.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, right off the top, it's rapid fire phrasing. So, and you know, they were kind of going through that time. We were kind of paying attention to the world. You got kids and Matt does and Trevor does, and they were kind of, you know, stuff. The world was going through all kinds of stuff at the time, and you're kind of wanting to talk about it, but not being hokey about it, you know? So how can you say this stuff yet still, they've got a cool factor to their band too. So how do you have an inspirational song and not look sappy? So, you know, I had that track prepared before we got there, and it had almost like a kind of Southern gospel-y vibe to the whole thing. And they really liked it. And we sat on the back of the bus, and I'm trying to think how that title came out. If one of the guys had that, or if it just, so sometimes you just kind of get off to the races running, you know? But that hook to me really emphasizes the perfect example of taking a inspirational song but wrapping it up in a cool twist, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's all I got. I know I was only supposed to talk to you for 15 minutes, and but you have so many interesting stories and stuff, so I really appreciate the time, and I look forward to meeting with you down the road at some point.
I appreciate it.
Thanks so much to Jesse Frazier. Next week, we're talking to Brock Berryhill, who's co-written songs for Kane Brown, Brantley Gilbert, and Kenny Chesney, among others. See you in 7 days.
100 years of radio, 100 years of hitmakers.